As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away. All with our award-winning commentary, opinion, and insights. Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Very good evening. Welcome to the game live from Birmingham. I'm Jim Prowther here for an evening of informed and passionate football debate. Just imagine if Gab Marcotti had been brought up here in Brum, had some grey hair, take away a bit of the cynicism. Here I am. This evening, we'll touch on some of the big domestic and international topics, as well as a few a little closer to home. For example, why does such a large football-loving region like the West Midlands not host Champions League football every season? How have West Brom thrived despite the loss of Peter Odemwingie? Can't work that out. To discuss this and much more, please welcome my panel, Times football writer Rory Smith, Times football editor Tony Evans, and our special guest, former Coventry, Villa and England star, Mr. Dion Dublin. Okay, let's start by talking about the Villa. They're one of the most popular clubs in the country, it says here. Certainly the second most popular in the city. They have consistently underachieved in the Premier League era. Yeah, I think that is fair to say. 20-odd years into the Premier League era, and they haven't hit the heights that they should have done. Yeah, well, they haven't hit the heights they did in the 80s.
No, they haven't. I signed in 99, I think it was. Jim, and hold it a minute. No, we won the Intertoto Cup. Let me get that right. We won the Intertoto Cup. Thank you very much. Just so I'd get that in, you know. That's my biggest claim to fame in Villa. But since 1999, Villa have really done nothing, achieved nothing. Even with Martin O'Neill, getting to Wembley, was it twice? Was it two finals? Two semis, was it at Wembley? Was it finals? Finals. Yeah, just it's poor for the size of the club. Even when I was there, we underachieved. And it's wrong that Villa are not playing, as you've said earlier, Jim, it's wrong that Villa aren't playing Champions League or even challenging for Champions League places. The size of the club, the size of the fan base, I think it's the players, the owners, and the managers that have just underachieved completely.
Let's have a show of hands in the audience. How many of you support Villa? So that's getting on for one in three, something like that. How many of you are satisfied with the start? How many of you Villa fans? We'll put your hands up again. Now put your hands down if you're satisfied with the start that you've made to the season. Okay, so that's most of the hands have gone down. The two that were up looked a little bit embarrassed and thought, I can't be seen as being the only ones that aren't happy. Do you think, and Dion, I'll throw this one to you first, do you think that the club is moving in the right direction at the moment?
At present, I think they are moving in the right direction. I say that because of the players they have in regards to the age of the players, what they're trying to do with their youth academy, which I think is fantastic, started from Kevin McDonald, Tony McAndrews, Sid Cowans. They are doing the right things in order to take Villa in the right direction. I think it's the team that goes out onto the pitch that's underachieving for me. The players are trying their socks off to make it work. We haven't got enough quality at this present time at Villa in the big squad of players to contest any other top five or top six team. No way.
I think the problem is we're seeing it in the here and now. what we've got to do is we've got to look back and see how this developed. You know, Randy Lerner come into the club and pumped a lot of money into it. For three consecutive transfer windows, Villa were in the top three spenders in Europe. And I'm not a Merton O'Neill fan, but Merton O'Neill did not do a good job there at all. And what I do like about Villa is that they've gone back, they've taken a step back and they've said, you know what, this hasn't worked. Lerner's not going to spend a great deal of money. They're going to let the youth system come through. Last year, they danced on a tightrope. It was. It looks as if they could possibly go down. But, you know, they said, we've got Paul Lambert, we're going to stick with him, we're going to let the kids come through, and they'll develop and we'll be better for it. And I think in the long term it will be. Obviously, it's not very satisfying now. A club like Villa should be bigger. A club like Villa should be, you know, really successful. And the other problem is, you know, unlike in the early 80s, there's not enough scouts there, you know, Ron Saunders, John Goodman.
You know what, Tony, the frustrating thing is, and I'll guarantee that the fans will back me up here, is talking about Villa and talking about, you know, going down. You shouldn't be in the same sentence. You know, you shouldn't talk about Villa and they've done well to stay up. Last year, they did do well to stay up. Villa doing well to stay up is an embarrassment.
But the problem is that what Tony says is right, and I'm contractually obliged to say that. It's written into every time contract that I have to agree with everything he says. But, and you kind of want, as a fan, even as a neutral, you want to think it's great to see that them looking through the lower leagues, getting young players, bringing kids through. There's some good players there. Westwood's a good player. Benteke was obviously the big success. Matthew Loughton, the right back, is excellent. They have done well. But in the modern Premier League, that is going to take you to what, 10th? Because someone else is going to come along and either buy your best players or spend money on other players who are better than the kids that you've got in your first team. And that's the problem. That, to me, I agree. I think Villa should be in the top six. Top six or top seven. They're as big a club as Spurs and Everton, no question. They deserve to be up there. The problem is that O'Neill spent all that money. It didn't quite work. He got quite close, to be fair. And Lerner kind of said, right, well, that's it.
I'm going to cut the tap off. He soured an owner who'd come in and be prepared to spend. And Lerner's reined it all in now. And obviously, it's going to be very, very difficult for Villa to get back and compete with, you know, the likes of the top four clubs. I mean, the American owners have a very different vision of how clubs should work to, say, I don't know, Abramovich or Abu Dhabi. And it's going to be very difficult for Villa. But I do think they're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I do.
They've got one other problem, which we might touch on later, which affects probably all the parts of the country that aren't London. And to an extent, it doesn't apply to Manchester because of United. Football is becoming much more London-centric because that's where the foreign players want to live, it's where the foreign owners want to buy, and it's where all the money is. If you look at Everton, who've done brilliantly well, they've done what Villa kind of should have done. They've got 10 corporate boxes. Goodison Park has 10 corporate boxes, whereas Arsenal have got 350,000 or something. And Monaco want to build a stadium that is comprised only of corporate boxes. And that's the problem.
Yeah. You're saying that. That's a problem. I don't think it will be so much of a problem. Because the interesting thing is, match day income is going to become a very much smaller proportion of general income for football clubs over the next few years. It's even got smaller now. For example, Liverpool's owners won't build a new stadium the way Arsenal did because they say it's not worth the expense. And frankly, all the money's going to come from television. The next television deal may well be in the region of three times this deal, which is like 5.5 billion. It could go over 15 billion. I mean, the team that gets relegated as bottom this year will earn 60 million quid, which is what City got 2 years ago for winning the league. So I don't think that's going to be that much of a problem.
Do you think that Paul Lambert's plan is working? Martin O'Neill, and this is a very simplistic view of it, obviously. Martin O'Neill has gone out and he's bought 30-something players with plenty of experience in international caps, and he's paid over the odds for them. Paul Lambert has gone the other way, and he's buying loads of guys who are 19, 20, 21, and he's hit absolutely the jackpot with Benteke, but probably not hit the jackpot with many, Loughton maybe, but with many of the others, they haven't really been a success.
Yeah, the majority of the others are kind of decent, aren't they?
So is there a happy medium? Do you think Villa at the moment should be looking at a happy medium, bringing some experienced players in and some stellar youngsters? Or is that just an idea? Do you think that's what they are trying to do and they can't do it?
It's hard to get the stellar youngsters, though, isn't it? They don't. The stellar youngsters, for reasons known only to God himself, go to places like Chelsea and City and sit on the bench and then in 3 years' time wins that they're not getting first team football.
But he's done that, though. Rory's done that with Benteke.
He has, and Benteke was a brilliant. Someone told me the other day the story behind Benteke's signing. I can't remember who it was. Someone completely bizarre recommended him, Benteke. It might have been Wilmots. Wilmots ran him. He played with Wilmots in Germany. Or I think maybe Wilmots was at Schalke while Lambert was at Dortmund. Wilmots ran him out of the blue and said, sign this kid, he will score you goals. That's hitting the jackpot. But as I say, the problem is that the other players are all fine. There's not many bad players there. There's no one, I've seen Villa 3 or 4 times this season, there's no one you look at and think, God, you're terrible at football.
Well, Villa have had stellar youngsters. They've had stellar youngsters. Gareth Barry is a stellar youngster. Lee Hendry would have been a stellar youngster if coached in the correct way. Darius Vassell could have been a genius if coached in the right way.
Hero in Turkey.
Exactly. Surprised he's still alive.
You can't criticise him in Turkey.
Jaylord Samuel, those kind of players, you know, they were, you know, Darren Byfield, they all could have been amazed. So they've been doing it for a long time, Villa. They've been bringing the young players through for a long time. They're the ones that I played with. And they were very, very good, talented youngsters, but they just don't seem to keep them and bring them through to the first team and stay in the first team.
Well, that's the issue, isn't it?
Which is why I don't know. I really don't.
Well, as soon as someone like Barry stayed for longer than maybe he thought he would, but as soon as he becomes a kind of a big name, someone nicks him, that's the problem.
But that's all about the management, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and I think in Lambert, I'm a Lambert fan, and you know, I think he's got the right attitude and he'll get the right sort of mix. I think last year he didn't have enough experienced players to help on the youngsters. But I think we're seeing that develop. And I think it's all about management. Because you know what? And Mourinho always says it. He says there's a cigarette paper in terms of talent between the very best and the very worst in the Premier League. And it's about getting them to play for each other. And what Villa has shown for me, and I've only seen them once this year, but they played for each other, they're working for each other. And, you know, some of those stellar youngsters that we talked about, they don't play for anyone but themselves.
Let's go to you guys again in the audience. Is Alex here? Alex Skidmore?
Yeah.
You forgot his name.
Took him a while.
You're Alex, by the way.
Alex, yeah, the more difficult questions are coming up, I can assure you.
Okay.
Alex, thanks for coming tonight. You emailed us to talk about the recruitment policy down the road at the Baggies, and they've been able to bring in the likes of Sessegnon and Amalfitano.
Yep.
Do you think you're a Villa fan? I'm guessing.
No, I'm a West Bromwich Albion fan.
Oh, you're a West Brom fan. Okay, so from your lofty vantage point, crowing on these Villa fans beneath you, do you think that your transfer policy is better than Villa's?
I think it's pretty obvious that we've finished above them for the last couple of years suggests that it is, and spent a damn sight less than they have. I agree with some of what the panel have said, that Lambert's doing an okay job at Villa, but at the end of the day, Lambert's spent probably £20 million the last two summers running, and he's actually not done much better than McLeish did. Granted, the football was better, but I think that West Brom have bought in players who have made an impact, have played probably a better standard of football and finished above them. So, and for substantially less wages and potentially substantially less fees. So I think our recruitment drive is probably a little bit better. Granted, our players have probably got lower resale values than what Villa have bought in, but that's not the be-all and end-all when the Premier League is set up how it is now, that actually you get money for now, not for the future.
Sure, great point.
Do you know what? Tony's right, obviously, it is about management. The manager has to get the best out of the players. And I think Lambert, I like him as well, I think he's a good manager. Mm. But there is this myth that you can't succeed if you don't spend any money at all. You look at Amalfitano at West Brom, who's not even the best player in his family. Is it Morgan Amalfitano that's at West Brom? Was it Roman?
Morgan at West Brom.
Morgan at West Brom, and Roman's at Newcastle.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, Roman's the better player. He never plays, but he's meant to be the better player. Morgan was, I guess, they kind of ignored him at Marseille and let him go out. But he looks a world beater. And if you scout well, you don't have to spend a lot. You can't get into the top six doing it that way. I think that those days are gone. But if you scout well, you can build a good side on not very much money.
Here's the problem for West Brom, though. I mean, obviously, things have changed there over the last year or so. People are looking at Steve Clarke now. I mean, Fulham, Martin Jol's likely to leave Fulham before too very long. Clerk's way up on their list of people they'd like to buy. I mean, people are looking and thinking, well, you know, we can get in there because they haven't got a lot of money. We can take people.
What's
off
the point of managing Fulham? What are you going to do at Fulham?
They're probably going to pay you more. And, you know, and then it's, let's face it, you know, if the Telegraph come in for you, you'd go for more money. No, he actually wouldn't. He actually wouldn't because he's already been there.
I think I'm very much the David Bentley in that scenario. Yeah,
but you know, it's in terms of potential, it's West Brom's a difficult sell. Because there's not a great deal of money there. Jeremy Peace is a difficult chairman to deal with, and I think what's going on there is wonderful. I think it's absolutely brilliant, but I think it's one of those places where it could go wrong pretty quickly.
I think with from the outside looking in, I think that the way that West Brom's run is it's very much like that. Very steady. Mm. There's no fluctuation with the way that they deal with their company, and I think they do it in a way that gets players to play for the club rather than for themselves. You know, we mentioned about the young players playing for themselves. They want to play for West Brom. There's very much a togetherness at West Brom, and you can see it on the pitch at the moment. You know, they're not going to pull up trees, West Brom at all, but there's very much a togetherness with the club, and it comes from the top. And I think Steve Clarke is doing wonders. They play some great football. And I think it's great because I think Villa struggle with that way because Villa are like that.
Yeah.
And there's no stability at all. That's the difference, I think, between Villa and West Brom.
Does anyone see, I mean, you know, sort of being West Brom fans, did you see Steve Clarke being a success? Because I'd, you know, obviously seen him at West Ham and as Dalglish's deputy at the Anfield.
As a coach.
And I didn't see them playing the style of football they're playing, which is really good, and the pressing game they play is fantastic.
He's what they need, isn't he? He's a proper coach. He's not a manager.
Rory, I think you're right. That's it. I think as a coach, fantastic. I think he knows the game inside out. He's played at the highest level. As a manager, I wasn't too sure about him. But as a coach and as a number two, I think he's done great. And I think players to respond to great coaches. You know?
And in that model, he doesn't need to do a lot of the managerial stuff because, is it Richard Garlick, the guy who's replaced Ashley? He takes care of the transfers, the scouting system.
If you coach well, you're a manager anyway. Yeah. If you coach well, you're a manager. Ron Atkinson was the manager at Coventry City when I was there. Gordon Strachan was the coach. And we all went to Gordon Strachan for advice. never to Ron. Honestly, Ron was a flipping nightmare. He was a nightmare. Gordon Strachan would set out a training session with all the really channels like a flipping, you know, flight pad. And Ron Atkinson would run out with his Predators on. Remember the old Predators that had rubber on? So he could bend the ball. Remember them ones?
Yeah.
Ron would run out with his Predators on and say, forget that. Don't be doing that. No five-a-side today. Just give the ball to me. Give the ball to me. But then you gaff, hold it a minute. You're about 40 stone. You're not very good. And we're going to listen to Gordon. We're not going to listen to you. And that's how it was. You know, we listened to the coach more than we did the manager. If the coach is good, you know, they'll get more respect and more response from the player.
Well, that's what they always said at Liverpool, was that that Clark's training sessions were really, really good, different every day. And what you'll obviously know quite a lot more about this than me, but what a lot of the players said there was that they were different. It wasn't the same thing over and over again. You get coaches who just do the same routines, the same kind of exercises.
Ray Hodgson.
Come on to that. Whereas Clark he varies it. It's different. They're original. Makes the players think.
So then you go into a training session. You go into a training session on a Monday. You know you got something. Tuesday you got something. Wednesday probably off. Thursday, Friday, it's all different, you know, and you're right, it keeps the players fresh. What are we doing today? What are we doing today? You know, no one's thinking, oh gosh, it's Thursday, we're going to do keep ball for an hour. It's what a nightmare. Then you start, get players, oh, gaff, I'm a bit tired today. Come Friday, they're fit again. You know, that's
I refuse to believe any footballer ever does that.
No, not my shift.
Let's finish this section with a show of hands from you guys again then. How many of you think that Villa will finish above Albion this season? That's Dion, your vote doesn't count because obviously you're biased. So that's half the Villa fans haven't put their hands up there.
Well, the four at the back, come on, lads, get your hands up, geez.
So that's probably.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's probably four. Well, that's getting on for 5%, no more than that. Everyone else thinks that Albion will finish above. How many think that if Benteke got injured this weekend and didn't kick a ball again for the rest of the season, Villa would go down?
No.
That's probably a third, I guess. About a third.
Do you know what? People are queuing up to go down. Villa way at the back of that queue.
Well, you've only got one spot. Just Sunderland are appalling.
Yeah. And Palace are
Crystal
worse.
Palace, yeah. Are slightly better than Sunderland, but seem to be determined to become worse by appointing Tony Pulis.
Mm.
So those two are down.
Yeah.
And then so you got one other spot. Villa won't go down.
No, Villa won't.
No chance.
Not this year.
Well, they might go down at some point in the future.
Hi, my name's Mark, a West Brom fan. You mentioned Tony Pulis, and I've got a query about the Times today. I was reading it on the train. I can't remember the name of the journalist, but it wasn't one of you guys. Gary Jacob,
yeah.
Who linked Clark with the Palace job. And I read that, and then he screamed out loud on the train. Why would he do that?
Because Clark. He's right.
Yeah, he mentioned Steve Clark as a possible candidate for the Palace job. It's in the Times today, page 70.
Yeah, well,
the reason he did that, and I was in yesterday, I was in late, but the reason he did that is because he was briefed that who they're interested in, and obviously there is an awful lot of interest in him, you know, whether he'd go there, he'd have to be criminally insane to go there, but, you know, it's like, football, it's one of those things, it's one of the difficulties of football journalism. Everyone says, you know, people tweet me all the time and say, the Times transfer stuff is like, transfer, this site which rates your transfer success has only got your 30%. Well, that's not what we report. What we report is interest and contact, and there is interest there, and there is undoubtedly contact. Steve Clark will say no. Pulis effectively has been told the job is as if he wants it, and I don't know. I think it's all mad. But you know, it's Rafa Benitez's favourite phrase: football is a lie.
Yeah, to be fair, Gary knows more people than exist in the world. So, this isn't sort of company loyalty. If the amount of times I ring Gary, does our window watch thing in the summer? The amount of time you get someone like an agent or someone rings you and you think, fucking hell, that's a good line. This is going to be the top of window watch. He'll be pleased with me. I won't get bollocked for the day. And you ring Gary, and he goes, yeah, mate, I already know. Yeah. Every single time, it's really depressing. But if he's written it, he'll have got it from a decent source.
Seriously, I mean, this is a man who has. He once told me, and this is about 3 or 4 years ago, he has 3,000 contacts, and he tries to make contact with them all at least once every 3 months. And you're like, it's lunacy. But one of the biggest lunatic things of his is you get told things, and obviously they're probably not going to happen. But people have wishful thinking, mm-hmm. And I think Crystal Palace have a bit of wishful thinking there.
The one that's maybe worth watching for is Mackay. Because I think Mackay is ready to get out of Cardiff. I think he's actively seeking a way out.
Seeking a way out. They're showing him the door. There's a big pointing sign there going, Malky, there's the door.
Guys, thank you very much indeed for that. So we'll come back to talking about Midlands football a little bit later, widen it out away from just Villa and West Brom. But now I want to talk about England. And after the euphoria of last week came an instant tabloid storm. So let's have a look back at what happened. How do my esteemed colleagues view the fallout post-qualification? Dee, I'm going to start with you. Is Roy in any way, any shape or form whatever, to blame for his Space Monkeys joke?
Yes. Well, he said it. It was stupid to say it. It was something that that he's used before, apparently. But it just happened to be to a black person, which just wouldn't have gone down well with any black person. But you happened to choose a black person that was offended by it. If he said it to me or directed it to me, I would have spoke to him. You know, it's easy for me to say that, and I'm 44 years old, I'm a senior pro, so I'm, you know, as a player, it's very different because he's your manager. So if it had happened to me, I would have said, Gaffer, listen, I thought you were a little bit out of order there, Gaffer, but, you know, and that's what should happen to the seniors. The seniors should sort this out. The seniors should actually go to the player. Who is it directed at?
Townsend.
Okay, so the seniors should go to Townsend, say, listen, I've worded the Gaffer, I'll come with you. Gaffer, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he'd have gone, listen, I didn't mean like that. Roy didn't mean that at all. Roy's not a racist at all. He didn't mean it. He said the wrong thing. He said, I didn't mean to say that. And that's it. You know, and I don't think the racist thing does get on my nerves a lot, to be fair, because people get accused of racism when they're not racist. They Roy, for instance, is one. I know that Ron Atkinson said it so many times. What about Ron Atkinson on that, what's that program? That when they go in the house and all that kind of stuff. Big Brother. What about Ron? Oh, my gosh. If he hadn't kicked two guns and shot himself in the foot, he'd have missed. Unbelievable, Ron is. But he's not a racist. You know, Ron says so many racial things, but he's not a racist. Roy, I know, is not a racist. He said the wrong thing. He's apologised for it. Move on. You know, let's not make a mountain out of a molehill. You know, we've got a job to do in the World Cup. Let's just kick on.
When it comes down to it, you can't legislate for what's going to offend an individual and what isn't. I mean, it's not our place to say you should be offended by that, you shouldn't be offended by that. But having said that, you can look at the fallout that's come from it, and it appears to be an indicator of disunity within the England squad. The whole thing has been managed by some of the England players very badly, hasn't it?
And there are various theories how it all come about, and some of them suggest it was not an England player who actually dropped the story. I guess we'll never know the truth. Personally, I don't associate monkeys with black people. Some people do, they're not my sort of people. Roy Hodgson is, I don't think he's a racist. I think he's a bumbling fool at times. I think he's a reasonably good football manager at times. There are legitimate questions to be asked about Roy Hodgson and his attitude to race, but they go back to his coaching career beginning, which everyone says, all his friends say, began in Sweden, when actually began in apartheid South Africa. And that's a legitimate question that should be asked. But I kind of think it wasn't asked at the right time. I think what we saw last night in Moscow and what we see frequently in places like Italy and places like behind the old Iron Curtain puts the racial problems in the game here into perspective. We clearly, there are problems here, and there's still problems. The Suarez thing was a big issue, and I think he got off lightly. I think the John Terry thing, again, is I think we need to address the fact that players saying they are saying things and doing things to unnerve opponents. If they've got a racial component, we got to get that out of the game. But I think the space monkey thing was one of the most manufactured controversies I've seen in football, and one of the worst stories I've seen.
I've got to admit, and do you know, you get really nervy talking about stuff like this, and whenever we do it in the studio, you can see...
You better get nervy as well.
But you see, even Gamble will basically say anything in the world, and even he tenses up. I think the question I have about Hodgson and the space monkey thing is, what on earth was that? Why not just say, give the ball to Townsend? Yeah. What is wrong with you?
That's his name.
Why do you need to give some sort of elaborate story? Just say, Chris, pass the ball to Townsend. He done it enough.
That's what you get from him. That's what you get from him. He's like, he rambles, he roams. And let's face it, all managers are mad. All of them are mad.
Yeah.
You know, it's a... The things that go on in dressing rooms, Dion will probably, you know, and we only get the slightest hint, Dion would know some stories. But the loons, you just got to accept it.
But the thing is that, I agree with that. The issue is, with racism, is that, and it's obviously brilliant that we're so kind of on it all the time, that any sort of hint of it is criticised and is addressed and talked about. But as long as there are racists in the world, there will be racists in football. There will be occasional incidents of racism. It's not football's job to lead the rest of the country. It can be an example, but it's not its job. It's not football's duty to sort of show the rest of the country the way. It can be a leader, but it's also a reflection. So you are going to get idiots in crowds who make racist comments. You can't, every single time that happens, you can't be like, and football's got a problem with racism. And Britain has a problem with racism.
And here's my problem, which what happened last year with Suarez, with Terry. What it did is it gave the closet racist the chance to come out of the closet and talk their bile. And this is where I think in football we need to clamp down on it. We need to stop giving those who are looking for the opportunity to use football as something to piggyback on and put forward this, you know, these views. We need to clamp down on it.
But also the work that's been done is incredible. If you think about how, I know that you get there were the two, there were Suarez and Terry, and there were these two high profile incidents in a relatively short space of time. But they were the first two that I can remember
for years.
And what, I mean, to be fair, Suarez isn't English, and neither's Everett. So it's hard to blame English football for that.
I'll guarantee you, and I know this for a fact, there were more racial attacks in my time when I was playing than there is now, behind the scenes, on the training pitch, that never got out. One happened to me when I was at Cambridge, and one happened to me at Cambridge United. And any black person in here, Asian person, knows that if something's said in a racial way, we know if they mean it. Simple as that. And it works both ways. It works both ways. Not black to white, white to black. It doesn't matter. Works both ways. He said it to me when I was at Cambridge United, this player, and he meant it, so I chinned him. Yes. Fact, I chinned him, right? Chinned him, and then I picked him up, and I said, listen, you bang out the boy. I said, Dean, I'm really sorry. Within 2 minutes, that incident was finished, done. We played together the next game, and we're fine. What I'm trying to say, it was done and dusted. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, because it's not the right thing to do, but it's done and dusted, and it went. These have gone on for so long.
If you went to the FA Commission, you could suggest like a punch a racist initiative.
I think that's right. I'm up for that. No, it's not. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying we know when somebody means it. Correct. We know when somebody means it. And I've got so many white mates, Far East mates, Asian mates. Doesn't matter. We have banter between us with blacks and all the wrong words that we say between us. It's fine. You know, the whites say to me, the Far East people say, it doesn't matter. But when you say it and you mean it, there's a bit of an edge to that. Yeah. Then that's too much.
I think... We don't give football in this country enough credit for it to move on.
I agree.
I'm friends with Clyde Best, who played for West Ham. At the time, he was the only black player in the league.
Yeah.
And whole stadiums would be making monkey noises at him. And the abuse he took was unbelievable. And here we are with 30, 35 years on. And it's almost not an issue. We're manufacturing some of it, like last week.
Well, and the other thing is, in terms of football, I mean... When was the last time you saw a Premier League team without a black player?
Well, the best ones have got as many black people as possible.
Yeah.
All the best teams have got loads of black players.
Well, no, but it's true. If you look, this is going to get me in loads of trouble. Because you can say it, but I can't say it. If you look at Harry Redknapp's, Portsmouth team, it was a load of players that he's brought in from sort of Francophone Africa who were beating strong and quick, because they're the sort of players you need in England. Technically excellent. People like Sully Muntari. The best Premier League teams have, if not a balance, you probably half and half.
Look at Ron Atkinson. How many black players did Ron Atkinson sign? You know, Dalian Atkinson, Ian Taylor, all those players, Hugo Ekiog, Smalley. Just, you know, a lot of them are black players. So we've got to be careful how far we go with this. And I think you're right. I think Tony's bang on. We've come a million miles away from where we were. And I think that the FA and the Premier League and the Football League and the PFA have done absolute great work to get it where it is today.
So that, of course, overshadowed what should have been a pretty euphoric time for England. Qualified for the World Cup, playing well in two games. Let's have a look ahead. No, go on, Tony. You're looking at me with raised eyebrows.
Playing well.
I mean, playing well by the standards that England have played in the last two or three years.
Okay. Sit back now.
This was a poor group. This was a really poor group. And even in the last couple of games, there were spells where they looked ropey. However, I've got to say, I think there are young players coming through that will give Hodgson options come next May. And I think England will feel a lot better about itself going into the World Cup, notwithstanding the issues that have dogged the qualification process.
There was a more attacking approach in those last two games, through necessity, Rory. So is this the new England, or are we going to go revert back to type with 23 behind the ball?
No,
play for a 0-0 draw against the worst team in the group.
They'll leave Brazil known as the great entertainers, definitely. That fits absolutely.
That's exactly what I was thinking
with
as well.
With Roy Hodgson's entire 36-year career, he's managed not just Neuchâtel Xamax in Switzerland, but two teams in Sweden. I think Tony's right. I think the profile of English players is changing. It's quite interesting to see why it's changing. I think that five-a-side and more street football in less economically well-off areas has changed the profile of players. The people like Sterling and Zaha are proper street footballers. Ravel Morrison's another one. All those little tricks and skills and fakes and all that. I think there is the potential there in a few years' time to have quite an exciting team. I think Hodgson will go, probably rightly, relatively cautious in Brazil.
One thing that I criticised England, especially in Ukraine, for the way they played, no one worked for each other. It's been a characteristic of England for a decade. The best teams work for each other, play for each other. Kyle Walker was left hung out to dry by Walcott in Ukraine. Over the last couple of games, they were actually working for each other a bit, and I see that as a positive thing. Mm.
So do we look ahead on the basis that no one here expects us to win the World Cup? Oh, what a surprise. No hands at all, not even a solitary finger raised in the air.
This is the key thing with England. What counts as success? If you listen, I don't support England. Does I support a Yorkshire independent state?
But I'm Scouse.
And he's Scouse. I think that getting to three quarter finals in 2002, 2004, 2006 is pretty good. I think that's a decent performance. If you're one of the best eight sides in the world and you only lose on penalties, you kind of have to say, all right, do you know what, we'll take that.
No matter how you got there?
No, not really. You want to take the 2004 European Championship?
I think they had players to get further.
They did have players to get further, but I think you can't count that as a proper failure. So what counts as success for England?
Okay, well, let's put it out to the floor. What does count as success for England? If England were to get to the quarter finals, gentlemen, would that be regarded as success at this point in time, however many months it is beforehand? A show of hands again, please. Who thinks that would be a successful World Cup campaign? That is probably, 80-90%?
Yeah. But is that just because you think England, you correctly think England are rubbish?
Sorry, what was the question?
Is that because this is how a lot of my interviews go? Is that because expectations are lower with England now than they were maybe 4 or 5 years ago?
It's not, expectations have been really high over the last few tournaments, and the fact that they're low this time doesn't mean that quarterfinal will be acceptable or not acceptable. I think ideally for England, a country of its size and its heritage and prestige, I think semi-final would be acceptable to most people. And the fact that we've gone out a lot of the time last minute on penalties has just left a sour taste in most people's mouths. And I think that's what's causing most of the problem in this country, and the press just want to jump all over it.
I think because of the way how you started this topic, Jim, because of the way we have gone about the qualifying, I think come the World Cup, expectation will be back where it normally is. England can win the World Cup again.
I think
it'll be exactly back where it is again. We'll be kidding ourselves again. We're not good enough yet. And I think Rory's bang on with the players, even Morrison's and the Zaha's. I don't think England are brave enough to change. They're not brave enough to change. I think what it is, they do look to the players like Lampard, Stevie Gerrard, Rio, who I think should be in the squad, by the way. They should be, this is my opinion, they should be in the squad. You need a backbone of quality and leaders and seniors, but you need to have the backbone, say, hold on a minute, get Zaha in there, get the young lads in there. Listen, go and do what you've got to do, because we're not going to win it. Be honest, we're not going to win it. Go and show me what you've got. Go and show me what you've got.
So there's a case to be made for almost looking ahead and planning for Russia and saying that the young guys who really could prove to be the backbone of a team that could be very successful in Russia should be given this chance in Brazil. We know we're not going to win in Brazil, so give them the chance. Take two or three of the old guard, but start building a team now.
No, you know what? That's Greg Dyke corporate bollocks. You know what? Right, they've got to look to win the next year.
You could have just said no.
Right, you know, it's like...
He can't.
You know,
he's not physically capable of it.
It's like Greg Dyke comes to the FA. Oh, the illusion of management. Let's set up a commission. Yeah, and let's all talk about it. It's crap. It really annoys me. The fact is...
You can't tell.
Right, the fact is, England have had players that could have done better at World Cups and possibly should have come near to winning World Cups. So, Dion's point, one of the problems is about the older players, and I'm talking about Steven Gerrard, I'm talking about Frank Lampard, I'm talking about Wayne Rooney. All of them are very self-centred and want to play their own game. There's been a lack of leadership from them. Hopefully the younger generation will work for each other and will go further. You don't need to have superstars to win World Cups. It helps. If you've got Maradona, you're laughing. But Maradona was the only superstar in 86. Right, you can win it. It's a tournament. It's a knockout tournament. You can win it by getting the right mindset and getting people really working out for each other. And England will have an opportunity next summer. And I'm not an England fan, but by God, they sell people.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So the two are ranked.
There's no... I can safely say there hasn't been a World Cup winner that hasn't had a superstar. At least two or three superstars.
Germany in 1990.
No superstars.
Maybe Mateus.
Well, there's one then. So they did have one.
But no, he's not a Maradona or a Pele.
No, but there are players, exceptions in a squad. There are always exceptions in a squad of players. And I always say this. The best, the good players in a side affect games. The great players can win games. You know, Messi can win games. Pele and Rivellino's can win games. You know, everybody's got a great player. Everybody's got a good player.
But I think England have had and do have players,
yeah, I agree,
who could stand out like that if they actually won. I mean, the thing is, I don't think Messi will ever win a World Cup because he's not Maradona.
Can we remind you of that?
You can remind me that.
July the 14th.
You can remind me that. Messi is not going to win a World Cup. Argentina aren't good enough. And he's not good enough to lift the rest of them like Maradona in 86.
Let's throw it out to the floor again.
Hi, my name's Hugh and I support a club that's probably far too insignificant for any of you on the top table.
I'm a Torquay fan. They won't be too insignificant for me. I can assure you.
Memories of playoff semi-final against Torquay as a Shrewsbury Town fan. So
we won. That's all right. You can ask your question.
I know. I drove there and I drove back as well. Isn't part of the problem though with England that the riven with inadequacy in preparation? I mean, the under 21s this summer not taking players who could have gone and got valuable tournament experience, and then you look at the goalkeeping situation. I mean, Joe Hart is the best keeper in the world. There's no doubt about that. But if he gets, you know, but if he gets injured and he drops a jar of mayonnaise on his toe, then he's given no game time.
What
to
the chances
his,
of Joe Hart dropping anything?
His girlfriend might do it. But
catching or dropping?
They've given no game time to any of the support keepers. So if you've got to bring someone in because of an injury or a suspension, which could happen to a goalkeeper, none of them have got any real experience.
Do you know that is one of the big things with England is. Well, it's kind of two of the big things within them. One is the complete and utter inability to understand that you don't use the 21s to bring individual players through. You use it to bring an entire team through. I disagree. I think you have to go into a tournament thinking you can win it. The way teams win World Cups, partly with superstars, having an outstanding player or two, or an outstanding generation, but it's also by nurturing a team in the same way as you would at a club. You do that by bringing them through the 16s, 17s, 18s, 19s, into the 21s, and then you bring four or five of them into the senior team. So they know how to play with each other. They have a pattern of
but
play.
The problem is they work with each other. But the problem has always been, having covered a lot of under-21 football, that you get to a stage where you've got an Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, for instance, and Roy Hodgson will say, I want him.
Yeah.
And Arsene Wenger will say, well, he certainly isn't going to go and play for the under-21s over the summer. So it's the club managers that stop that happening.
It is partly, but it's not just them. Hodgson shouldn't be calling Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yeah, he shouldn't be. And I don't know what you think, Dion, but I think that in any world, you've got to progress, you know, and like you move on and you learn. And if you're a kid like Sterling or Oxlade-Chamberlain and you're thrown in against the best international defenders, you're going to find it hard. At the under-21 level, you've got the level below. So you work your way up, you learn what you have to do, what tricks you have to learn, and you develop. And like, and the thing is, they're missing a crucial part of development. It's almost like the X Factor. You know, you're an unknown 1 minute, and then suddenly everyone in the country knows your name. You can't cope with the fame. It's same with football. You can't cope with dealing with it all. And we've lost sight of letting people grow and develop.
I think in the fame aspect, Tone, I think what it is, when you're on the football field, fame goes out the window because you're there to do your job and you're there to contribute your part to the team's performance. That's what you're there to do. Now, when you're on the pitch, I think there's an element of you do need that little bit of experience in regards to young boys need to be coached in a way.
Yeah, so I was thinking more of the mechanics.
Yeah, exactly. But there is an element, and there's an argument for a young player going in not knowing what failure is like. So they go into a situation where they don't really know who they're playing against. Mm. They don't know what the how much of a big factor it is to not play well or to not play well against Lothar Matthäus. And they don't fear anybody. They don't know what to expect. They just go and play. Mm. And sometimes we take that out of players. We don't let players just go and play and just show us what you've got. That's why I think Zaha is one of the most exciting players that we have sat on the bench or in the stand. He's not really getting a chance as yet to show us. What he needs to be coached to stop doing so many, you know, lollipops and leg overs. What Ronaldo done when he arrived at Manchester United, I'm not comparing the two, but Ronaldo done it. He'd done it two or three times, too many times. He got smashed all over the park, and then thought, hold it a minute, if I keep doing step overs, I'm going to get smashed by the fullback. So what I'll do one and cross it, or I'll do one and shoot. And that's what you've got to teach him, when to do it, where to do it.
Well, I mean, Townsend's come in, showed no fear, gone past people, and he's done brilliant. Yeah. Now, the difficult thing is, in the World Cup against the good teams, the really good teams against Germany, just knocking the ball and going past them won't work. He's got to learn a little bit more, and that's what you got to do.
Are you suggesting, Tony, that the lad who plays for Lokomotiv Sofia and Montenegro isn't the best left back in the world? Because I think Andros Townsend proved himself against the best.
I think he's probably on par with me. Like, I can at least use the line.
Okay, let's take another question from the floor.
Hi, I'm James. I was just wondering if the panel think Hodgson will be bold enough to take a few young players such as Sterling and Morrison, providing he doesn't mess it up this year.
Rory? Ravel Morrison, a month in Brazil. You'd film that, wouldn't you?
Well, he's no Carl Pilkington, but he's probably not too far short.
Yeah, I think he probably will, to be honest. I think I'd maybe fall between the two, actually. I'd take people like Lampard and Gerrard. I mean, Gerrard and Cole will be there on merit. I think Lampard might not go, to be honest. I think he's fading quite quickly all of a sudden, is Lampard. Yeah, I would have thought, and I think he'll go for Carrick, and then Barkley will go if he's fit. And then I guess the other one is what, Morrison, or there's a few others. But no, I think he'll take, I'd be inclined to say the same. I think you build a team you target either a Euros or a World Cup, and you build the team through the tournaments before it. So I'd like to see Morrison there, I'd like to see Barkley there, Zaha. I think Raheem Sterling needs to be taken somewhere and taught how to cross the ball without just fucking flicking it up straight to the goalkeeper, which is incredibly frustrating.
The thing about managers, whether it's international managers or Premier League managers or whatever it is, or team managers, then the thing about it is you have to know how to manage the individual personality. If you can manage an individual personality, the footballer will look after itself. It's an absolute fact. Sir Alex done it for 25 years, 26 years, managed the best players in the world. He didn't coach. So Alex can't coach. He's a rubbish coach. He left it to Brian Keane and all the best coaches in the world. He just he managed his team of personalities. That's what he'd done. That's why he was so successful. If Roy Hodgson can do the same with Morrison and the Zahas and the Lampards, whoever he picks, if he can actually manage their personality, they'll be fine.
You're gonna get slaughtered in this next book. You know that, don't you? Now that you said he can't coach.
Listen, that's happened many a time before. It won't be a shock.
Well, you know what? If it comes down to Roy Hodgson managing personalities and players, he's a screw.
Thank you very much for your thoughts, everybody, in part one. We're back in a few moments' time, looking at the general malaise of Midlands football. That and much more on its way. Welcome back. More ovations tonight than we know what to do with. Thank you very much indeed for coming back for part two of the game podcast. So, we've talked about the general situation in the West Midlands with Villa and West Brom. But you have to look at the Midlands in general, the East Midlands and the West Midlands together, and say that really it is an underperforming part of the world. And I say that as kind of a closet Birmingham City fan as well. Blues are having a bad time. Well, it's nice to know I'm not on my own. Blues are having a bad time in the East Midlands. Leicester, Forest, Derby, all struggling as well, having had fantastic spells earlier in the Premier League era. So, an easy question for you, Dion. Why?
You know what? I don't really know. Leicester's my hometown, Jim. You know, Leicester's my hometown, and it's just they get so close to the playoffs, and they get so close to getting promotion, and they just cannot achieve it. And you look at Forest; the history of Forest is amazing. They can never get there. I think this is the Midlands got more football clubs in such a small area than anywhere else. It's just, Jim, the answer is I don't really know, but I do know that the clubs in the Midlands are big enough to sustain Premier League status. Leicester, for instance, was there for years and years and years. Forest has got so much history. Obviously, the Villas and the Birminghams are more than big enough to be there. But again, the whole of the Midlands is underachieved, and I think it's just through lack of quality footballer.
Too many clubs in a short space.
Yeah,
is it any worse than Manchester?
I think Lancashire. Dion's right. There's loads of clubs in the Midlands, but Lancashire might push them close. There's about 50 and about 20 miles around there. But no, it's an odd thing. And I think partly it is because of the. Maybe not so relevant kind of in the future, but it might be partly to do with the lack of kind of economic vibrancy in the Midlands compared to London, which is something that affects the entire country.
No, I mean, you know, like you say, in Lancashire, in the North West, there's like loads of clubs, but Liverpool and United have risen above it to be global forces, and Liverpool are underachieving now. And like, yet no one in the Midlands has done that. I mean, you know, Villa won the European Cup, which was a brilliant achievement. But there's never been a Midlands club, since probably, in memorable history, that stamped themselves on the top flight and have won titles. And it's a really strange syndrome because the region produces players. It's got loads of fans. And it's one of those inexplicable things. I don't know. Is there anyone out there who can tell me why?
I'd quite like to know why St Andrews is always empty, apart from the fact that Birmingham are rubbish. But there's loads of rubbish clubs in the Championship. There's loads of rubbish clubs in the Premier League. You look at St Andrews, and it is always looks like there's about 15 people there.
Well, the it's drafty. I would say at the moment, the situation at Blues isn't indicative of the general situation in the club's history. At the moment, they're underachieving. They've got no money. They've got a bloke in charge of the club that not a single supporter wants to be in charge of the club, and they're unwilling to put, you know, the hard-earned cash in at the moment, and hoping that things will just sort of tick over until Gianni Paladini or whoever is in a position to buy the club and cast some young sails. And I would like to think it will then improve. It might not, because until they get Premier League football, it might still look half empty all the time.
Interestingly enough, it was a couple of years ago, well, probably 5 years ago, when people were still, before the credit crunch, people were still talking about investing in football. I was talking to someone in the city, and they said to me, which teams would you be looking at if you were going to want to take over? And you know, that they're underutilised assets, as he said. And I said, like, well, you know, Cardiff, they could be a regional flag bearer. I said, Birmingham City. And unfortunately, we've seen they've been targeted by the sort of people that we wish wouldn't come into football.
It's kind of a lottery, the Championship. You can chuck 15 million at it and lose, or you could do what Blackpool did and spend 60 grand and win.
But the people on the outside can see the potential the same way we can. And they come in, and they're not going to put any money into it. They think it's going to be easy cash, you know. And everyone thinks football's easy, and of course they end up taking money out of the club because football's the only business you can asset strip on an annual basis and get away with it, and it leads to a spiral. And I fear for Birmingham at the moment. But you know, this region should be way better.
I tell you what it is, Tony. In my opinion, I look at Derby, and I look at Leicester, And I'll put Reading in there because the point I'm trying to make, they're in there as well. But you look at Coventry City, they've all changed their stadiums. They've all, you know, it might sound stupid, but Highfield Road was a fortress. Rico is empty. You know, Reading's never full. Derby's never full. You know, it's you take away the history and the passion of the football club, and you do start to lose the fear factor within that club. And you do get a little bit carried away. Hold on a minute, we're doing okay at Highfield Road. Let's build a bigger stadium, make more money. They've never filled it once. I tell you, the only time that they filled the Rico is when David Buist had a testimonial against Man United. That's the only time they filled the Rico. That's for David Buist, and rightly so, by the way. But I just think you've got to live within your means.
Bon Jovi must have done it.
Off a stadium.
How did they get on? Did they win Bon Jovi?
Bon Jovi always win.
The mad thing is, Coventry in particular, they were like Tottenham at the forefront of the new age of football. They were the first stadium to go all seater. You know, it's and then they backtracked about 87, and but kind of they saw the future. Coventry and Irvine Scholar at Tottenham, they were like the mad prophets of the Premier League, and now the drunks in the corner, like, you know, it's just like saying, you know, we told you, and you don't listen to them. But I don't understand why the clubs in this region are struggling so badly, because the support is quite good. Even at Coventry, obviously not now, but like, you know, you still draw reasonable crowds. And is it that, and I'm asking you this, is it that you jaundice the lack of success that people aren't going to match?
Anybody got an opinion on that? You look at Coventry being in their worst situation for years, and Wolves are down lower than they've been for, you know, 25 years or so. Is it a geographical thing? Is it something to do with this region?
Hi, I'm Richie. I'd posit that football, by and large, is a product of society around it, so it's going to mirror the kind of trends that are happening around you. And the Midlands isn't exactly the coolest place in the country to be, so people are going to be... People are going to be attracted to London, they're going to be attracted to Liverpool and Manchester because of the cultural iconography of those areas. I don't think the Midlands has that, so for the young players coming through today that tend to be attracted towards those kind of things, I don't think they're really areas they want to succeed in. If they're living and working in those areas, they're always looking to other areas that are more attractive that they want to go and work in. And I think that's just a product of society today, really.
So what you're saying is once HS2 is in, and you know, everyone can live in London and come and play in Birmingham. Sorted.
And you're telling me the black countries are attractive?
Sorry, my name's Riz. But
you grew up on Scotland Road in Liverpool.
You can't exactly say that I'm from Birmingham, obviously, but you can't exactly say the North East's a great place to live, really, is it? And they've got Sunderland, you've got Newcastle, you've got Borough, kind of.
So. Yeah, but that's absolutely true. But I think that's not only a great point that uses the term cultural iconography, which I enjoyed, but if you look at the North East, they've got real problems attracting players, and it's not just young players, British young players, it's foreigners. Foreigners don't live in the North East because it's miles from anywhere, and an Egyptian. When Hull signed Gedo, the Egyptian striker, his agent ran me and said, "Where is Hull?" And I said, "Well, it's kind of near Leeds." And he went, "Where is Leeds?" And I went, "Well, it's the centre of the universe." And he didn't. He seemed to think that was Cairo. And he said, "How far is it from London?" And I went, "Well, it's quite Hull's a long. I mean, it takes ages on the train." And he went, "Oh shit! I've told Gedo it's really close."
that goes all the way back, doesn't it, to like 78 when. It's helped me if I didn't go blank on his name when the Argentinian.
Oh,
came to Middlesbrough, and his agent told him it was a suburb of London.
Surely, if you're just paying someone $40,000 a week and he's from like Egypt or some kind of second division French team living in a ghetto, surely living in Birmingham is better than that.
Well, he's going to get $40,000 a week playing in London. So you know that's the argument. You know, he's going to get that kind of money wherever he plays.
Surely,
you know,
even the younger people, okay, they might want to go to London, but to play for a professional football club on a decent salary should
absolutely
still be a draw.
Yeah, see, but that's, old school, that's an old school thought. It's an old school thought.
You see, I don't buy that. I think what affects people, and from agents and players I've spoken to, is you've got to go somewhere where there is a sense of progression, that you'll go forward, that you can improve your career, and that things will be happening. And the feeling I get
is outside Villa, there's a sense of Villa's moving in the right direction, and to a certain extent West Brom. There hasn't been over the last few years, and there isn't now, that sense of progression in the Midlands.
I think what it is as well with the players, unfortunately nowadays, players are surrounding themselves with some wrong'uns. You know, they surround themselves with the wrong people that actually tell them that they're better than what they are, or go to this football club because it's going to be great for you. It's not going to be great for you. It's going to be great for me because I'm going to get 50 grand in my account and you're going to get 15 grand a week. They're surrounding themselves with the wrong people. Therefore, they're saying to themselves, well, go to that club, go to that. It's not going to work for the player. It only works for the agents and the people around them. So I think it's down to the players being incredibly naive and not going somewhere for the football, but going somewhere for the surroundings, which is the wrong thing. And I think you're bang on there. You've got to go, play your football, learn your trade. It's a very old school way of thinking, but you've got to go, learn your trade. 40 grand a week. Flip. I wish I earned 40 grand a week. To be fair, I'd be on about 300 grand a week if I was playing now. I'd be the highest paid player, by the way, let me tell you.
Back out to the floor. Gentlemen, I'm sorry, I can't even see because of the lights.
Your point about why Midlands are underachieving, I think there's two points. One is bad management of the club. So you take Wolves, they were doing okay with Mick McCarthy, they got hammered by Albion, it was a great day from my perspective, and they sack him, but they've spent their money on building a 35,000-seater stadium they didn't need. That's just bad management, and look what happened since then. And then now it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So West Brom had a player called Izzy Brown, not many of you will have heard of him, yeah. I don't think, but was on the fringes of the Albion squad. He wants to go to Chelsea. Chelsea come in for him. When is he ever going to play for Chelsea? Mm. That's just a really bad move. But because we're in this cycle of sort of, you know, they're chasing money and the Midlands are underachieving, he goes to Chelsea. A horrendous career move. It'd have been much better staying like Berahino. Hopefully will stay.
So it's almost a vicious circle. Then you have this fallow period, which becomes self-perpetuating because nobody wants to get involved in that. They can't see a way out of it, so it gets worse and worse and worse.
But you know the mad thing about players going to clubs where they don't play, they're miserable. There is a myth, and I think Dion will tell you that players are happy to sit on the bench. Have you ever met many players who are happy to sit on the bench?
There aren't players of I know what you mean, Tom, but of my era, there aren't players that will do that. No. There's a very small percentage, I'm sure, that will, but there's not a lot of players I know of my era that will do that. I think it's changed now, to be fair. I think it's changed, but in my era, no chance.
But not that much. They're unhappy. They're angry. Their lives are miserable. They make loads of money. But frankly, they make loads of money playing. And I think Dion's got the point and made a great point. Their agents need to point them in the right direction, saying, look, all right, you might be making 20 grand less a week, but in the big picture, it won't matter. You know, it's you need to play. And I feel there's a certain movement now back towards that, and hopefully people come to Midlands clubs and want to play. But as for Wolves, Steve Morgan, who refused to buy Liverpool for 85 million because it was he wanted to knock them down by 7 million, and it's one of his friends is Christian Perslow, that great football genius,
the Fernando Torres of football finance.
No wonder Wolves are screwed.
The thing is about Wolves is that it is absolutely bad management, and you can say the same to some extent at Forest, Leicester pre the tie group before King Power, Derby before the Americans at Derby are quite well thought of and stuff. It kind of counts on individual levels, Birmingham obviously, but it doesn't explain why there is that. It is a pattern that the Midlands clubs are underperforming. It's too much of a pattern to be going to.
I think the most important part is the Midland clubs haven't energised the support bases.
To play devil's advocate, if you're an agent of a 21-year-old footballer, what you say to him when Chelsea or City or whoever come calling is not going, you'll earn 90 grand a week here. You sit on the bench, don't really matter if you play football. What they say is, you have to go now, because what happens if you get injured in 6 months' time? Yeah. That money never comes. So they look at them and think, the players, I think, know but that they're taking a risk.
But that's agent speak for, you could be on an extra 20 grand a week, which means I could be on an extra 3 grand a week. That's what the agent is saying. It is as pure and simple as that.
There are obviously agents who do that. There are loads of bad agents. There are some good agents, and I think they would still tell the players to go.
More good agents than you think.
You know what? The story that I'm going to tell you now is absolutely 100% true, and it just relates to what you're saying there, Rory. David Buist was injured for 3 months with a hamstring. On the Friday, Ron Atkinson said to him, listen, you've done really well, kid. You've got yourself fit. I'm going to start you on Saturday against Manchester United. He said, come see me Monday and we'll sort you out a new contract. David Bewes said, yeah, no problem at all. Playing against Man United, broke his leg, never played against, never seen a penny.
And that's the world that footballers live in.
That's an old school way of thinking. A new school way of thinking. The agent would have said to the player, hold it, get that contract signed Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
Let's get this money sorted out just in case you get injured.
And that's why players need agents. You know, don't just like say agents, you know, are the wrong part of the game. There's in American football, there's a famous saying by one of a player. He says, every time we say it's a sport, they say it's a business, referring to the owners. Every time we say it's a business, they say it's a sport. Players need protecting, and agents need to protect them, and they should get them the best deal they can. But sometimes the best deal is playing.
Before we go on, Jim, sorry, I've got to say, I had the best agent ever, a guy called Struan Marshall, and I'm happy to name him. Stevie Gerrard's agent, he is. Best agent ever, looked after me incredibly. Look at Stephen Gerrard, look at Jamie Carragher, great agent.
And I'll tell you what, people talk about when Stephen wanted to go to Chelsea, and people criticised Struan Marshall and said, nah, you know, he's driving it all. He didn't. Stephen drove it all, and Struan said, you stay at Liverpool, it's the best thing for you.
Let's completely change tack. Talking of Stephen Gerrard, I understand he's mentioning Fergie's book.
Yeah, apparently shit.
I saw that as well. Because Joey Barton tweeted it. He said, Fergie, as good as putting cones out as he is as player recognition. Gerrard, shit, question mark. So, Fergie's book. Why has he done it now? Is this pissing on the Moyes bonfire, for want of a better phrase? That bonfire I'm that's trying well
to,
alight.
I'm trying to visualise that image. I don't know. I'm a bit surprised he didn't wait a little bit longer. Maybe he wanted to get it out on the shelves in time for Christmas. Well, that's the big
deal. Well, to be fair to him, he's not gonna lose any money by it, is he?
If we're gonna pick on this point, I have to say, Ferguson has some justification. He says he's not world class. He's not world class. However, to compare him to Paul Scholes and saying Scholes was the better player. Scholes is the most overrated player who ever kicked a ball in British football. And you know what? It's like Nasri tweeted when he retired for the first time, England Zizou! You're laughing, comparing Paul Scholes with Zidane. Come on.
Do you know what? That's obviously a ludicrous opinion and massively overblown. But
that is 100% right. Football hipsters, you know, believe it. Oh, Paul Scholes.
No.
Paul Scholes was Sammy Lee.
What I would say about Scholes is that Ferguson's logic for saying Gerrard isn't world class, and I think there is an argument that Gerrard's not world class if you look at what he's done on the world stage.
He's not world class.
But surely all the same things apply to Scholes. Scholes never did it for England.
Well, let's hang on a minute. Let's have a straw poll. So, any Liverpool or Manchester United supporters in here? Okay, you're not allowed to vote, right? Because, let's face it, I know which way you're going to vote. So, of the rest of you, with footballing affiliations closer to where you're brought up, who would vote for Scholes as the better player? I'm voting as well. So that's I'm going to have to do a count.
And who votes for Gerrard?
Okay, so how many voting for Gerrard? Do you know something? That is dead level.
It is.
So it's a toss of a coin.
It's apples and oranges, isn't it? They're different players. But I think they're both wonderful footballers, but I think the way that Ferguson criticised Gerrard for not having done it at the top level can also be said of Scholes.
The less balls Scholes kicks, the greater a player he becomes.
But that's the same of everybody, though, isn't it? I mean, Gareth Barry was England's best ever midfielder when he was injured.
Well, someone described Dion to me the other day as England's Pelé.
Is this the Pelé that plays centre-half for Southampton and West Brom?
It cost me a lot of money, to be fair. I'll take it.
Moisey is not having the best time of it. Is the book going to help him in any shape or form? No. How much damage is it going to cause him, Tony?
I think it did little damage because there wasn't a great deal in it. It was a damp squib, really, wasn't it? It was a bit all told. It's not new. It gives us a little bit more detail. You know, what we should be asking, and what would be really interesting asking Alex Ferguson, is why he got into trouble with the owners over Rock of Gibraltar, and then, which basically let the Glazers through the door, and how he facilitated the Glazers to take $580 million out of the club over his tenure and run down the squad while United are earning more money than almost any club in the world. There are real serious questions that should be addressed by Ferguson, and he's a genius. His genius has been shown in the last 3 or 4 years when, with a weakened squad, with a substandard squad, he's been competitive and won things. But by God, this spook, what a load of old tosh.
So after that glowing recommendation, is anybody actually going to buy it?
That's going on the Amazon review with it.
Tony Evans, 4.5 stars.
You know tosh. What? I mean, and this is a man in the book. You know, he says he's on the left wing of the Labour Party. Yes, but he'll take a knighthood, you know, because he's against the class system.
He sucked everybody in. The guy's an absolute genius, so Alex Ferguson. Yeah. As a manager, genius. For winning what he won with the players he had, they weren't the best. I think 92, you know, take me out of the squad because I wasn't there for long.
But you made the difference.
If it wasn't for me, they wouldn't have bought Eric Cantona, let me tell you that, by the I am the catalyst to their success. I break my leg, they get Cantona, the rest is history. In between 92 and 94 was possibly, in my opinion, their best squad. 95, you know, Ince's and the Robsons and the Cantonas and the Kanchelskis's. They were untouchable. They were amazing. So what Sir Alex has done now is he's brought his book out, and what's happening is what he wanted to happen. We're all talking about it in forums. He's got Keeney on board. There'll be more come out of this. Let me tell you. And all it's going to do is lying the gaffer's pockets. He's very, very clever to do that. You know,
Tia, what was he like?
It's gonna be a bestseller.
What was he like when you were dealing with?
To be honest, I can't. It's hard for me to say a bad word against the manager because he was, to me, he was amazing. I break my leg on
he's a brilliant manager.
Yeah, on my Old Trafford debut, I break my leg. I don't know. 3 weeks later, I'm at home on my own doing the 45th jigsaw, I think it was. And I've got my cast from toe to groin, and he knocks on my door and says, "Dion, listen, you know, I just wanted to let you know that I just want to invite you on a trip, on a European trip." And so he invites me on a European trip. I said, "I'll get you 2 seats, Dion, no problem at all. You're on crutches, but we just want to take you with us." So he wanted to keep me involved. Come Christmas, knocks on the door, Dion, "I brought your present round." He brought my present round, which was towels, by the way, Marks and Spencer's towels. So, but you know, he's that kind of man. I respect the man so much. The guy's a genius. 92, when they won the first Premier League, I'd only played 8 games. I only started 8 games. You need to start 10 games to get a Premier League medal. He pulled me aside and said, "Listen, if you hadn't have broken your leg, you'd have made 30, 40 appearances for me, no problem at all. I'm having a medal made for you." Simple as that. So he had a medal made for me. Now, I don't know if you know that the very first medals, if you've ever seen one or not, you probably haven't, there's only 60. I'm just sniffing and stuff. And it's like a miniature Premier League. So you get like a baby Premier League with the little handles on and all that kind of stuff. And it's got your name on it and all that kind of. And he had one made for me, you know. So I was the 60th one that was ever made. So to me, I can't knock Sir Alex Ferguson any way, shape or form. He's great to me.
He's a brilliant manager and a class act when dealing with people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what he does. It's what he does. To deal with Eric Cantona, I don't know if you've ever been in Eric Cantona's company at all. Eric Cantona's about 2 inches taller than me and broader than me. He's a big old unit, you know, and what a player he was, by the way. And Eric turns up at Mark Hughes' testimonial. Mark Hughes' testimonial, 10 years at Man United. I'll be as quick as I can, Jim. 10-year testimonial, Man United Celtic, right? At Old Trafford, 50,000 people. This is before they built on top of the 50,000 bolt. So we all turn up, right? And I'm sat next to Sharpie and I've got Inchy on one side, and it's like 5 minutes until deadline time. We're in the dressing room now, 15,000 Celtic fans waiting for us to come out, and 35,000 Man United fans waiting for Eric to turn up. 5 minutes, and we're thinking, "Oh God, don't be late, Eric, don't be late. It's the first testimony you've been to." We're now in there in all the gear, red shirt, white shirt, white tie, all that kind of stuff, all the gear. Eric turns up, ripped jeans, white Nike t-shirt, denim jacket, collars up, and white Nike trainers. That's how he turned up, and we thought he's going to go mental, but he didn't go mental. He did not go mental. He had a word in his ear, went out, had a blinder, scored about three, and then that was it. And he kept Eric on side. And if Sharpie had done that, he'd have been sacked.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He'd have been sacked. 2 weeks later, sorry, Jim, 2 weeks later, exactly the same scenario, Dennis Irwin's testimony, exactly the same scenario. We're sat there waiting, not again, Eric, surely not. No, surely not, surely not. Eric turns up, we're all like that. What's he got on? What's he got on? What's he got on? He turned up immaculately dressed, exactly the same as us. Happy as Larry, no problem at all. White Nike trainers. So what happened? He'd got him on side, but Eric had kept his own twist on things.
Just what I take from that story is you were wearing a red shirt and a white tie.
I wish it was. I got a bit excited.
Reverse
that, please, for the podcast.
So it's a white shirt and a red tie.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Sorry, Rory.
Because otherwise, that'd be a weird sort of Santa theme.
With a beard. Yeah, beards as well. Beards and hats.
Do you know what? Why did you ask that question? You've ruined my illusions. I dream about that tonight.
So on the basis that your free copy of Sir Alex's book is probably already stopping up, open some door in your house, and is going to be used for anything else. Which sporting autobiographies would you recommend?
Zlatan's is worth reading. You know, I like the American football stuff better. There's some great, great stuff. American sports writing is unbelievable. There is a superb book about the LA Raiders, written by the doctors. They were the LA Raiders in that time, not the Oakland Raiders, in the 80s, called Don't Worry, It's Only a Bruise. and it comes from when one of the Raiders wide receivers was knocked out. He's lying on the floor. He said, I can't feel my fingers and my toes. He said, I can't feel anything. And the club doctor sat him up and said, don't worry, it's only a bruise. And those sort of books, where Ferguson has avoided the stories that would like me go, oh my god, they're the books to read. Would be worth looking for. Another one by Deacon Jones called Head Slap, and an American football book. I wish I could recommend you a football book aside from Zlatan's, but most of them are pretty damn dull. My book on the 83-84 team, Liverpool 83-84 team, will be out next year, and that rocks!
Which one of those that you've ghostwritten do you want to plug?
I'd like to plug Champions League Dreams by Rafael Benitez, which I think makes the perfect Christmas gift. I don't read a lot of football autobiographies. I think there's loads of fascinating football books that if I mention, Tony will shout at me and accuse me of being a hipster. But I think if you really want to read an autobiography, Dennis Bergkamp's is brilliant. Stillness and Speed, that's a really good book. But then there's loads.
I haven't read that yet.
That whole kind of canon of football literature, the Jonathan Wilson stuff.
I think
the travelogue sort of football-y stuff is brilliant.
I think Paul McGrath's was just incredible. But Paul McGrath actually done a really a 10-story paperback as well. It was just incredible about his journeys to the training ground. I remember Alan Wright, the left back.
Yeah.
The little left back. He used to drive Paul McGrath in. I know, as a kid as well, imagine that. Stop here. So we had to stop at services, and Paul would get a bottle of whatever. And then by the time they got to training, the bottle would be finished, and then he'd have to drive him home, and then he'd have to stop again. You know, that's how it was, and that's how Paul lived his life. But to give you an insight on what it was like for Alan Wright as a young player driving Paul McGrath in, he'd just done as he was told, and that's the way Paul lived his life. He had no knees. His knees were shot. In your knees, I don't have any medical people here, your knees, there's patella tendons and all that stuff. Paul had nothing. Just bone on bone. And he was one of the best players I ever played against. So that's in answer to what you said, Tone. One of the best players I ever played against. Made me look stupid. And I think if he looks carefully in his pocket, I'll still be there.
I was speaking to someone the other day who said we were talking about the best central defenders that have been in Britain, and McGrath was the first.
Oh, absolutely. He didn't even try. He didn't even think about the game. He just done it so naturally. You know, pissed as well. And I think he was when he played against me, and he still made me look stupid.
Well, reminiscing about a Midlands legend is probably the best way to end tonight's proceedings. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for coming tonight. A round of applause as well, please, for Rory, Tony and Dion, the illustrious panel.
Don't forget, Jim.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.